But first, writer Alain de Botton. During the summer of 2009, de Botton received a phone call inviting him to spend a week at Heathrow Airport's newest passenger hub, Terminal 5, as Heathrow's first writer-in-residence. Since de Botton finds airports fascinating, he agreed. The result is the book A Week at the Airport. Alain de Botton tells Anne Strainchamps what it is about airports that he finds so compelling.
The thing about an airport is it's all there, all the themes of modernity, speed, interconnectedness, danger, pollution, beauty, efficiency, masses, mass society, loads of people, consumerism. It's all there. It's all at the airport. If you were taking a Martian around the world, you had only a few destinations, and you wanted to show the Martian, you know, what it was like in the modern world, you'd probably take them to an airport. It's a quintessential site of the modern world in all its horror and beauty. And I, for various reasons I can't even understand myself, I'm powerfully drawn to airports. I know many of them are nightmarish in many ways, but there's just something that draws me. And in some ways, I'm never happier or never more at home than in transit at an airport.
I've always thought the world is divided into people who either love airports, just love being in them, like the energy and the feeling that you could go anywhere in the world, and people who just see them as way stations to get through as quickly as possible. I guess you're the former.
That's right. I am the former. I mean, I completely understand. And after a long flight, I get where they're coming from. Absolutely. But I think there is a promise of change and alternatives. Just looking at the departure board, especially at a, you know, busy international airport, reading the international destinations, whether it's Tokyo, Rome, Zurich, Taipei, Sydney, and just sensing that within a few hours, you can board a craft that will, you know, in a day or so, land you up in a culture and a continent so different from your own. It's the opposite of mundane. It's the opposite of routine. It's an invitation to dream.
It makes me think of Harry Potter's world in a way. You know, there are all these portals. And at the same time, each of these magical little doorways could take you to another continent, even another whole different culture. And they're all just kind of lined up there. And at the same time, it's the ultimate in modern technology, right?
That's right. It definitely is a magical door. And the technology is impressive, too. I think, you know, there's a lot of gender division around this technology. I think a lot of women, not all, but a lot of women, just can't understand what's so impressive about a loud General Electric or Rolls-Royce engine at full throttle in takeoff. They just zone out. But I, as a grown-up boy, am pretty thrilled by it all. What thrills me is how careful thought by some boffin scientists in these large corporations can lead to a moment of a sheer display of strength, of power. I mean, that's really what it is. It's power. It's mankind creating a kind of roar and a sense of energy that has eluded humans for thousands of years. You know, thousands of years, it was the gods who made that sort of noise. But suddenly it's us. You know, it's just us taking off for New York. And it's impressive. It creates a feeling of technological awe.
The first thing a lot of us think about when we think about airports these days, sadly, is security. I don't think anybody actually enjoys the whole security process. You talked with some of the senior security officers at Heathrow. What did you learn from them?
Well, I began to sympathize a little bit with a job in which, in your professional career, you're unlikely ever to find the thing that you've been trained to find, or to deal with the situation you've been trained to deal with. So most security personnel will never meet a terrorist, will never find a bomb, you know, thank goodness, but they never will. And so they're always on the verge of, or often on the verge of, sort of not taking the threat as seriously as they might. So if you're the manager of the security personnel, you have to constantly awaken your staff to the sense of the dangers. So there were posters all over the kind of tea room showing, you know, well-known terrorists and blown up aeroplanes that had been a stark reminder of what terrorism could do. But then, you know, some chilling stories. I was joking with one of the people, why on earth do you x-ray pregnant women and little old ladies and harmless kids and all the rest of it? There's a famous story in aviation security, the Hindawi affair, where a Jordanian man incited his girlfriend, his pregnant girlfriend, pregnant by him, to board an El Al flight carrying what she didn't know, but what turned out to be a bomb in a plastic bag, so that she would blow herself, his unborn child, and, you know, 300 passengers up above Europe. Fortunately, she was caught at the very last minute, and this not very charming Jordanian man was arrested and still languishes in jail. But that was a reminder. It's after that incident that everyone however friendly the granny looks, they will x-ray her to bits as well.
Did you have a favourite time of day at Heathrow?
I think the evening is a sort of melancholic, haunting, but rather beautiful time of day when the only people left in the terminal, apart from the staff, are those who are going to end the day in the sky somewhere. So there's that feeling of, you know, setting sail, and you won't see your own bed or home tonight. People feel rather brave as they're sort of catapulted into the sky at that time when most of us are going back home, protecting ourselves from the darkness, going back to what's familiar. They're going the opposite way, into the unfamiliar. Mm. And so there's a kind of sort of lyrical feeling at that time of day. I've got a description of watching the planes coming in to Heathrow in the early morning and what they look like as they're all descending. I could read that.
Yeah, that sounds beautiful.
So I'm standing at the end of the runway, just looking at things coming in. With the aggressive whistling of their engines, the airborne visitors appeared to be rebuking this domestic, quiet English morning, like a delivery person unable to resist pressing a little too insistently and vengefully on the doorbell of a still-sleeping household. All around them, the M4 corridor was waking up reluctantly. Kettles were being switched on in Reading, shirts being ironed in Slough, and children unfurling themselves beneath their Thomas the Tank Engine's duvet in Staines. Yet for the passengers in the 747 now nearing the airfield, the day was already well advanced. Many would have awakened several hours before to see their plane crossing over Thurso at the northernmost tip of Scotland, nearly the end of the earth to those in London's suburbs, but their destination's very doorstep for travellers after a long night's journey over the Canadian Icelands and a moonlit North Pole. Breakfast would have kept time with the airliner's progress down the spine of England, a struggle with a small box of cornflakes over Edinburgh, an omelette studded with red peppers and mushroom near Newcastle, a stab at a peculiar-looking fruit yoghurt over the unknowing Yorkshire Dales. For British Airways planes, the approach to Terminal 5 was a return to their home base, equivalent to the final run up the Plymouth Sound for their 18th-century naval predecessors. Having long been guests on foreign aprons, allotted awkward and remote slots at O'Hare or Lax, the odd ones out amid immodestly long rows of United and Delta aircraft, they now took their turn at having the superiority of numbers, lining up in perfect symmetry along the back of Satellite B. Sibling 747s that had only recently been separated out across the world were here parked wingtip to wingtip, Johannesburg next to Delhi, Sydney next to Phoenix. Repetition lent their fuselage designs a new beauty. The eye could follow series of identical motifs down a 15-strong line of dolphin-like bodies. The resulting aesthetic effect only enhanced by the knowledge that each plane had cost some $250 million and that what lay before one was therefore a symbol not just of the modern world's daunting technical intelligence, but also of its prodigious, inconceivable wealth.
That's beautiful. You know, I was thinking you were talking about that gorgeous scene of people setting off in the evening, kind of wayfaring. I was thinking, for all that the airport is this sort of ultimate expression of our modern world, there is so much about it that has a kind of sacred feeling. I mean, for instance, when you think about what you're doing, you're flying up into the sky. Well, think about all those Christian paintings of saints ascending into the heavens.
That's right. I mean, religion is, of course, obsessed with flight in various ways and, you know, sacred beings appearing from the sky or earthly beings turning sacred by ascending to the sky. There's lots of sort of going up and down into the sky in religions. And I think there's been too much of that not to lend the business of going flying a little tinge of the supernatural. And I think we try and dampen it down by going to the duty free and by sort of squabbling and moaning about delayed flights, etc. But I think there remains, despite all the mundanity of modern air travel, there remains something eternally a bit supernatural about it. And potentially we should bring that out a bit. I think a flight is a very good way of, in a ritual sense, drawing a line under the past, trying to renew yourself, trying to make a resolution, perhaps. It's a pity that airports are such mute places. They don't admit how interesting they are on the whole. They pretend they're all very civilized. And then there's always a loud 24-hour news station blaring in the departure hall. And you think, why not let people take in some of the kind of giant drama that's going on here. Why mute it? Why normalize it all with the latest from the weather or the football game?
You spent a fair amount of time people watching during your week at Heathrow, too. Did you begin to kind of notice things about other travelers?
Yes. One of the great pleasures of airports is that you're allowed to stare at people while pretending to be merely reading your newspaper. So for the budding ethnographer, they're perfect places. By the time you're a writer in residence, you can actually ask people questions. So I asked a lot of people about why they were traveling, where. You know, the most amazing stories are there on a minute-by-minute basis. I remember a man stopping by and I said, you know, where are you going? He said, oh, I'm going to LA to see my family. I said, oh, right. What have you been doing in England? He goes, well, I've just been seeing my family. I said, with different branches. He goes, no, well, I've got two wives, he said. I said, oh, really? Do they know about each other? He said, no. I said, how many children do you have? He said, I've got six. I've got four in one place and two in another. I said, does this wear you down? He looked beaming and suntanned. He said, no, it's a little complicated, but it's fine. Of course, you know, one would never have guessed that. He seemed the most sort of respectable and ordinary of people. And the airport was just full of such stories.
Wow. As a writer, you must have just wanted to wander down the halls, spending, you know, eternity asking people questions.
Yes. I mean, it was almost daunting. There was too much. I felt like I had a teaspoon, you know, and I was trying to drink an ocean with it.
Near the end of your book, you write, travel agents would be wiser to ask us what we hope to change about our lives rather than simply where we wish to go. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that travel, as religions have always known, is a transformative experience from an inner point of view. You know, if you think of the old religious tradition of going on a pilgrimage was a journey undertaken explicitly for therapeutic purposes, to get over something, to encourage you to be good, to evolve in some way. And I think we still use travel to some extent in that way sometimes, but perhaps shy about it. And it would sound rather odd if we went to a travel agent and said, you know, I'd like to go somewhere and say where, and, you know, I'd like to go somewhere to get over my love or to find a new direction. They think, oh, this is a very strange customer indeed. We're supposed to know where we want to go and what we want to do with that place. But I think choosing a travel destination is a psychological activity. And I think in an ideal world of the future, travel agents would sort of merge with psychotherapists, and the art of choosing a destination to travel to would be taken as seriously as I think it should be taken.
Oh, I love that idea. Wouldn't you love to walk into a therapist's office and have them write you out a prescription and say, we really think you should go to the Galapagos?
Right, absolutely. A destination that would fit with the particular bits of yourself that are missing. And it might not be the same destination for everybody. In fact, it would be highly particular based on an understanding of your deepest needs.
And it might be dreadful.
That's right. As the tradition of pilgrimage shows us, being uncomfortable traveling can be an important part. You know, you might need to suffer. And that would be part of the journey.
Alain de Botton is the author of A Week at the Airport. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps.